Today on the World Cafe, we begin our week-long trip to Memphis for the next edition of our Sense of Place series. Throughout the week, we'll be highlighting the great studios in Memphis that created some of the most important rock and soul music ever. Today, we explore the rich musical history of Stax Records. While in Memphis, we were lucky enough to talk to Robert Gordon, the author of It Came From Memphis, as well as a forthcoming history of Stax, and LaVon Williams, curator of the Stax Museum, about the history of the famed label. Originally named Satellite Records, founder Jim Stewart focused on country and pop music. His sister Estelle Axton joined the business a short time later, and the pair learned that there was already a Satellite Records in California. They switched to calling the label Stax, a combination of the first two letters of each of their last names. And soon they also changed what kind of music they were releasing as well. LaVon Williams explains how that shift came about.
I think one thing that was very unique to Stax Records is that basically the co-owner of Stax Records in the beginning, her name was Estelle Axon. She operated a what's called the Satellite Record Shop out of the front of what used to be the lobby where Stax Records studios were. And through that, she basically was interacting with a lot of people from the community who would come in to buy records or to just to listen to records, not even buy. And she was so welcoming to them that a lot of them were like, well, hey, you know, we want to learn. We're musicians ourselves, and we want to learn about how to use equipment. And she was so welcoming to them that they became part of the Stax family, and some of them, you know, became some of Stax's biggest artists. Booker T. Jones of Booker T. and the MGs, that's how he got his start, through working with Estelle and saying, you know, I'm interested, I can play. Like, well, hey, let's hear you play. And, you know, and that's just one of several that came about that way. The building was originally the Capitol Theater. Once the theater shut down, Jim Stewart and Estelle Axton, the owners of Stax Records, they at this time were in a different part of Memphis working out of a garage, and they were just really, you know, unhappy with the acoustics that they were getting there, so they decided to move over here. The neighborhood itself had been a sort of, for the most part, white neighborhood, but it was changing to become more diversified, and I think a lot of people were dubious about whether they should start something over here, because the original plan was not to have a soul music record label. It was originally a country record label, but again, because of moving into this area, because of being welcoming to the people that lived in this neighborhood, I mean, it sort of evolved into what it became.
Robert Gordon, author of It Came From Memphis, gives his perspective of the beginning of the Stax label.
Stax was an accident, you know. They moved over there. Well, Chips Moman, who would later found American, had been engineering a lot of the early Stax hits, and he had an ear for black music and may have gone to South Memphis with the intention of recording black music. Jim Stewart, who ran the label, and his sister Estelle Axton, who ran the record store out front, they didn't know so much about black music until Rufus Thomas and his daughter Carla Thomas came in and cut an R&B song that hit locally. And then as Estelle set up this record store in the front, she began to tune in to what was popular, because people were saying, we don't want no Elvis records, we want, you know, whatever. And so she began to buy early R&B and put that in there, James Brown, you know, the King record stuff. And she was selling, she got her ear tuned in. Jim Stewart saw what sold and actually was very affected by hearing Ray Charles, What I Say.
Well, tell me what I say.
They weren't racist. They'd come from a small town about, I don't know, less than 100 miles from Memphis in rural Tennessee. Jim, as a kid, would occasionally go to the black church, sit outside, and listen to the music. So they didn't have, you know, they didn't come to Memphis with this racist notion that thrived here. And as they were establishing themselves in South Memphis, which was a black neighborhood, they had open arms to the people who walked in the door, and they kept the door open. And that's how the talent came in. All their early hits, William Bell, You Don't Miss Your Water Till Your Well Runs Dry, walked in the door. Rufus Thomas walked in the door. Booker T. Jones was pulled from his 12th grade algebra class to come play baritone sax, you know, around the corner. He'd been trying to get in. He'd been shopping at the record store trying to get in. How am I going to get behind that curtain, you know? And finally, the opportunity arose. So... And that's how Otis got there, you know. Otis came as the driver for Johnny Jenkins, who didn't have a driver's license. Johnny Jenkins had cut an instrumental hit in Georgia. Jerry Wexler said, "Hey, you might sound good with the MGs," you know, and he made that trip happen. And you know, in the last like 20 minutes of the Johnny Jenkins session, which had gone miserably. Otis Redding had been bugging Al Jackson, and Joe Galkin was in the room with Jim Stewart, and they said, "Okay, well, let's hear this guy." And, you know, Steve Cropper had to run out in the parking lot and tell people, you know, "Unpack your instruments, man, we're cutting some more." And that Otis stuff, where you could hear the pleading in his voice, Al Bell says you could hear the tear in his voice, it connected. You know, it was really simple music, really spare arrangements, and it just let Otis... you know, fill all the empty spaces. I think that's always what's been great about the Memphis stuff is it's not ego driven. It's all about what's good for the song. And at Stax, it was that way.
These arms are mine. They are lonely. Lonely and feeling blue. Arms of mine, they are yearning, yearning for wanting you.
Stax very much so was, you know, a family atmosphere, especially during the early years. I mean, everybody sort of, you know, powwowed here and worked together. You know, that's where those real relationships that made up a lot of those big hits came out of. I mean, these people were friends. They were either here or they were at the Lorraine Motel, which is where Dr. King was later assassinated. But that's where they would go to get out of here. There was no air conditioning in this building, so when it would get hot, they'd go over there and they'd be riding over there. It's, you know, but these people were actually friends and they respected each other.
Robert Gordon discusses one of the most famous collaborations and hitmakers at Stax, the Marquees.
They were a high school band. Their connection to Stax was that Jim's nephew, Estelle's son, Packy Axton, was the sax player in the Marquees. He admired the Steve Cropper Duck Dunn high school band, which was two guitars, bass and drum, and wanted to join them, and said to Cropper at the high school, and they all would hang out in the smoking room at the high school. Packy said, "I want to be in your band." And Steve said, "Well, we don't really need any horns." And Packy said, "Well, my mom and my uncle own a recording studio." And Steve said, "You know, Saturday at 2:00, we have rehearsal, be there." And that's how the Marquees got in the door. And they helped build when they were already in the door when Stax moved to this theater in South Memphis, and they helped take out the seats, build the facility. And I think they were the guinea pigs a lot of times for when Jim was trying to test the wiring, right? So the Marquees would play, and some of the Marquees had a lot of talent, and some of the Marquees were really great on stage, but not so talented in the recording studio. And as people began to come in the door in South Memphis, the better a house band began to form. And it was that house band under the moniker of the Marquees who recorded Last Night. So it's some of the high school teenagers, white teenagers, and it's some of the more seasoned black nightclub, R&B nightclub veterans.
Last Night by the Marquees. That song was out in 1961, a central example of the early Stax sound. Author Robert Gordon discusses the two phases of the history of Stax.
Well, you had the first period, which is all the soul hits that we all know and love, and it ends in 67, 68 with kind of three events that happen very close to each other. One is that Otis Redding's plane goes down and he and the Barkays are killed, most of the Barkays. The second is that Martin Luther King is assassinated in Memphis. And the third is that Atlantic, which was who Stax was released through and had a deal with, Atlantic was selling itself to Warner Brothers, and Stax decided not to go along. With that decision came the news that Atlantic owned their catalog and Stax didn't own their catalog. It had gotten snuck into the contract and Jim didn't read the contract. And it was devastating. And so that sort of ends the first period. The second period is the big change that happens is that Al Bell, who had been the promotions and publicity man, steps up and basically buys out Estelle Axton. And so the new partnership is Jim Stewart and Al Bell. And Al has it's the period of corporatization and conglomerates. Al has a conglomerate vision for Stax, and he wants to become, basically he wants to become the Columbia Records of the South. He wants to be a major distributor for other smaller labels. He wants to get into other media and will, in the course of his era, the sound becomes less defined. It more becomes the sound of hits, whereas you used to be able to have a sound, you could say, that's the Stax sound. You can hear the MGs. You can hear the soul. Then, in Al Bell's more expansive era, it was just the sound of hits. These don't sound like they all come from one place. You can't hear the stamp on them.
Stax Museum curator LaVon Williams on the two phases of Stax.
I think for much of the early era, there it was singles. I mean, I think that for black radio, that's what it was. You just wanted to get that hit single. But there was a sea change that sort of happened with one of the Stax artists when they released Isaac Hayes' Hot Buttered Soul. That really changed how people thought about what, you know, black artists could do with an album format. I think that other genres were really moving into the album format, but this was one of the first that really took the album format seriously from a black soul perspective. And I think that had, you know, a rippling effect that spread.
Author Robert Gordon on the importance of Isaac Hayes in the second phase of Stax.
Isaac Hayes really is the guy that the second era of Stax is built on. He'd been a songwriter and producer in the first era, wrote a lot of the Stax hits. And in the comeback, in the initial days of the second era of Stax, Al Bell, in need of a catalog, decided to create basically an instant catalog and release like 27 LPs at once and 30 singles at once. And they had gone out and gotten a sponsor through Paramount Records and Dot Records, Gulf and Western, actually, that was the corporate umbrella, the conglomerate umbrella they were under. And so they had money. So they were going to fly everybody in for this huge release as a way to say, Stax is not dead, you know, we are alive. Isaac Hayes they needed material. And so they had all their hit makers over there, and Isaac Hayes said, can I do one? And they said, yeah, you can do whatever you want, you know. Since you're not a hit guy, you know, you're not an artist, go do what you want. So Isaac puts out this record with four songs on it, two songs on each side. One song runs like 17 minutes, you know. Clearly, Isaac was not thinking about being a hit. Isaac just wanted to express himself. And his version of By the Time I Got to Phoenix began to get late night FM play in Detroit. It's in the full 17 minutes. And gradually it kind of spilled over to Chicago and began to grow from that area of the country to where Stax finally issued an edited version that could be played as a, you know, 45 single on AM and FM across, during the hit times of the day. And Isaac became a huge hit.
And by the time I get to Oklahoma,
should be sleeping. She'll turn softly in her restless sleep. Call my name out alone. Oh, then she'll cry just to think I would really leave.
So how did the famed Stax end, and when did the museum start? Curator Livon Williams.
Stax Records itself ended around 1974, and once they vacated this building, it became sort of dilapidated and was run down for a very, very long time. Around the late 80s, early 90s, it was sold. The building itself was sold to a local church in hopes of turning it into some sort of community center. That never came to be. So what happened was they completely demolished the entire building. This entire area was paved over, and the only thing that sort of stood as a reminder to Memphis of how important this place was a historical marker that sat outside.
Wow.
Around, I would say, maybe 1999, 2000, there was a movement with a small group of people, local people in Memphis, some of which were affiliated with Stax Records during its heyday, to create a space that sort of was able to perpetuate that legacy in perpetuity. And I think that movement was begun with the idea of the Stax Museum, but it also was thought of as a opportunity to bring back to this community what Stax Records did. For a lot of the people that were affiliated with Stax Records, this place was a finishing school, this place was where they learned a skill, a trade that they were able to use for the rest of their life. So that's where the idea for the Stax Music Academy, which is next door to the Stax Museum, came about.
As Stax Museum curator Livon Williams mentioned, the Stax legacy lives on, not only through the museum, but also through two different schools the Stax Foundation runs. Check out our videos of both the museum and the school at npr.org/senseofplace. There you will also find a special Spotify playlist of our favorite Stax tunes.